Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast, and we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
Bordering Belarus, Latvia, Poland, and Russia is Lithuania, whose capital is Vilnius. And if you were born there in the 1970s, when it was part of the USSR, someone predicting you would become a highly respected figure in Western finance, in fact, global head of research for Willis Towers Watson, who advise on over $2.6 trillion of assets, you might have thought that an unlikely forecast. But not so for one individual, my guest today, Luba Nikulina. Luba, спасибо, рад приветствовать вас в Эвонии.
Oh, я так впечатлена, Simon. Спасибо.
Well, here we are in London, in person, on Thanksgiving Day. It's great to meet you face-to-face and to be able to have this conversation. So thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Vilnius may be a short flight from London, but it was a longer journey for you, I suspect. So tell us first, what was it like growing up under the Soviet system, albeit in Lithuania, and what transpired?
Well, I cannot say anything bad about my childhood. It was a very good childhood. My parents took good care of me and started my life in Vilnius. My dad was a military officer and my family was based there. But I only spent 6 months of my life, the first 6 months, and then he moved around. So one of the interesting features of my childhood is that my parents moved around. And to a degree, it formed me as a person. So if I think about schools, in 10 years of the secondary school, I changed 10 schools. And so it really makes you think as a child how to adapt. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know that I was adapting, but I was. And also thinking about change. And I realized that this desire to continuously change things, it sort of stayed with me as a grown-up. And I finished school and at the university at the time when the Soviet Union collapsed. So talking about change, that was probably one of the biggest changes in my life, where everything that you believed in growing up all of a sudden goes upside down and you start figuring out how to believe in new things. So yes, that was definitely an eventful childhood, but I'm grateful for it and grateful to my parents.
So tell me a little bit, your choice of degree at an undergraduate level and where you studied before you then decided to come to the London Business School.
The role of luck and chance in life. So I really wanted to pursue a career in the armed forces, in military, because this is what my childhood was surrounded with. But as luck would have it, at the time when I was graduating from the secondary school, there was no female intake in the military college. So I had to look for something else. And the linguistics university was next door. So I thought, why wouldn't I try that? And this is how I ended up studying languages, which came very handy when I moved to the UK.
So London Business School, you obviously were beginning to think about finance or business training, or did you work before LBS?
I did work, and I did 7 years before LBS. They felt almost like another professional life because this was at the time of privatization in Russia, and I started career in finance without having a degree in finance. I had a degree in linguistics. So essentially, I had to work full-time and then also do the finance degree in the evening, and then we were buying businesses and were trying to make them better. So I came here to the UK in 2003 to do an MBA at London Business School in the expectation that they would train me how to run businesses and then I could go back to Russia and run them successfully. Well, I learned a lot at London Business School, but one of the first things that I learned that best practice doesn't exist in absolute. It's an ever-moving concept, and you just have to continuously learn and retrain and upskill.
Right, as you will probably discuss later on when we talk about good managers and less good managers and the process around that. So, setting the stage, Luba, you are managing director and head of research for Willis Towers Watson, listed on the NASDAQ, symbol WLTW. You are a leading global advisory firm advising on over 2.6 trillion of assets and have 45,000 employees in serving clients in over 140 countries. So a very, very large business. But I'd like us to concentrate on a few important things, which I hope you can really enlighten and educate myself and our listeners. And I hope today we're going to talk about your investment process and approach, what Willis Towers Watson as investment consultants do, how they do it, and the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, why you're favoring active over passive, smart beta, the challenges of selecting managers, neurodiversity, and finally becoming a non-executive director. So let's start at 500 feet. How would you summarize what your firm does and your role?
I work within the investment practice of Willis Towers Watson. So it's 1,000 colleagues around the world who spend their working lives thinking how we can manage investment risk better for our clients. Our clients, institutional investors, mostly large pension funds, but we also have endowments, foundations, insurance companies among our clients. And my team is just a bit more than 100 people, depending on which day you count. And we are also spread around the world. So it's a global team, which is really interesting to manage. And our job is to stay close to the markets and meet asset managers, assess their capabilities and find the best so as we could recommend them to our clients. So that's in a nutshell what we do.
Right. Well, we're going to peel the onion with a number of these. But one of the things we haven't talked about a lot on the show is strategic asset allocation and tactical asset allocation. And I know that specialists like yourselves and your organization spend a lot of time discussing with clients the notion of a strategic asset allocation. Can you explain how you think about, first of all, about strategic asset allocation?
I think about strategic asset allocation as something that probably makes sense to leave behind as a concept. It definitely had the place to be a few years ago. But now, if you think about the complexity of the underlying investment universe, you're probably not going to be positioning yourself to success as an investor if you split your assets into individual buckets and then try to fill these buckets. It's just not how we would think about success. So you mentioned risk budgeting. So if I think about the evolution of the whole asset allocation and strategic advice there, so we started with SAA, but then we moved to risk budgeting. So thinking about what risk premium exists in the world and how we find ways to allocate assets to this risk premium, be it equity or credit. So within credit, for example, I actually look across the whole universe, starting from indices and ending up with illiquid credit. What I'm getting is just credit risk premium. So that's another approach to asset allocation. But more recently, I would probably say the last couple of years, what we have been trying to do is position our business and also advise our clients to think about their portfolios as a one whole where every opportunity competes with everything else for their place in the portfolio. And we call it total portfolio approach, which means that as an investor, you need to ensure that people who bring your ideas, people who do research in different asset classes, they have a way to compare what they know about their asset class with everything else in your portfolio. If you think about myself, I started my career in private equity investing. And when I was doing just private equity investing, I thought that it was like the best asset class in the world. And I couldn't understand why anyone would do anything apart from private equity. And it took me quite a lot of research and understanding of public equity investing, passive investing, comparison of costs and value add that you can create to actually get this whole perspective of what it means for investors' portfolio. So it's pretty much the approach. So you have your risk and return objective, and then essentially you need to make your total portfolio work to achieve this objective. It doesn't help to have buckets. You need to think about the whole portfolio.
Right. And is therefore the ideal client one for whom you manage the whole mandate? But are there situations when you're only given a partial mandate?
Absolutely. Well, that's how life works. Sometimes we are a building block in a total portfolio. The way it works, our industry is about relationships. So you need to continue to justify that if you are a building block in the portfolio, then there is a logic while this building block in the portfolio. But you are absolutely right in your first statement, where we are at our best is where we can look across the whole portfolio. My team looks at all asset classes. I make sure that they are trained in a way when they think about the total portfolio. Our incentives, the way we are paid, are also aligned to the total portfolio results rather than individual asset classes. And I strongly believe that the way the markets work now, how complex it has become to invest, that's the best way to think about investments.
So just moving down to the tactical level, I believe you sit on the firm's asset allocation committee. I have been involved in tactical asset allocation for a long time. One of the criticisms I think that is rightly leveled is that asset allocation committees making tactical decisions tend to be quite incremental and feel very pleased about very small allocation shifts. How do you approach tactical asset allocation? And is there an example over the last few years where you've made what I would call a meaningful shift between or within an asset class?
Yep. So we call it dynamic asset allocation, and it's really difficult to do, but there are times where you can really benefit from that. And when you can benefit from that is when there are clear signals in the market. And actually, I can think about at least two clear signals. You are never 100% clear in investment. You always have to apply your judgment. It's a judgment call and it involves a lot of debate. But if we think about the end of 2019, early 2020, it was relatively clear that you need to protect your downside. So we actually decreased our exposure to equity and we worked on a tail hedge strategy at the time. So there was a bit of the luck there, but then there was also skill involved in finding the right manager and working with them on creating the strategy that was protecting the downside. And it got into portfolios in early 2020, which was very helpful in February and March. And then another, relatively quickly after that, the cycle unfolded in a way where there was a big debate. Do we re-risk or do we not re-risk when the equities were so low at the end of the spring last year? And I very clearly remember that there were people who thought that it can only go downward from there. But we, after a very rigorous debate, we decided to re-risk our portfolios. And there is an element of judgment call there, but then also it helps to have some sort of process there that you put the triggers there around your risk premium. And if it goes below a certain price, then you may have a bit more conviction and process supporting you in those rebalancing decisions. So we did re-risk. And as a result, 2020 was such a tough year for a number of reasons, but it was a very good year from a performance perspective.
Right. So having some of those specific markers or levels at which action prompted helps you overcome the human tendency, which is fight or flight.
Absolutely. It is just so important. I cannot overestimate the importance that the process plays in everything related to investment activity.
Okay, so let's talk about passive versus active. This is sort of the battlefield, really. We had Robin Wigglesworth from the Financial Times as a guest a few months back. He has written this book, Trillions, which is terrific and unequivocally makes the case for why you need to be passive in developed markets. I'm going to quote you that you are increasingly positive about the case for active. I quote you, I do believe that it's significant and it signals the reversal of the long-term trend towards passive. So you're in one corner, the likes of Robin Wigglesworth are in another. Tell me a little bit about why you are becoming more convinced increasing the weight to active is right.
Absolutely. So maybe firstly, I will start that it is a big debate and there is a tendency to position it as black and white, either passive or active. I don't believe in black and whites. I always think that the truth tends to be in the middle. So there are reasons why some asset owners have to stay passive. Some would prefer to stay passive. They would not have the governance ability to select the right active managers. Active is hard. But the comments that you quoted, Simon, they refer to the assessment of how passive has evolved over time. And there was a period where we were actively recommending increasing allocation to passive. It was a few years ago. But then as passive was evolving, if you look at the composition of the index, it has changed significantly. One of the benefits of investing passively is that you get diversification cheap. Well, if you look at the index, it's no longer as diversified as it used to be when passive investing just emerged. So at the moment, you are allocating to, depending on the index, 100 of 500 companies, 3,000 companies. But in reality, you are taking very significant bets on technology and some of the largest companies in the world. So it's just the structure of the market has changed. And as a result, passive investing has become much more concentrated and more risky. Another big trend there is just thinking about what's happening in the economy. I know that we would come to talk about climate change and the implications for the economy. It's very likely to lead to a significant rebalancing. And being in the passive index, you don't really have an opportunity to be as selective about future winners and losers. Having invested as an active manager earlier in my career, I just think it's really interesting time to be an active investor because you can do the analysis that allows you to get to those clearer signals than they were just a few years ago, where everything was muted by central bank actions. And well, we still have a flood of money coming from central banks and the government. But the climate change gives an opportunity to actually figure out the trends there, transition to the net zero economy. And that just gives a leg up to active managers. That said, it is really difficult to find high-quality active managers. That's why I have a team of more than 100 who spend all their waking hours thinking about what it takes to be a successful active manager of the future.
So that, I suppose, prompts me to ask two things. The first one is, has the fee compression in the active space also made it less of a difficult decision?
Absolutely. The compression in public equities has been so significant. If you think about just a few years ago, we were literally talking about 100 basis points. Now we're talking about 30 basis points versus, I don't know, 5, 6 in passive, depending on what sort of passive you do. What annoys me is that in the alternative asset classes, the fee compression hasn't quite kept up with what has been happening in public equity. So talking about active, it's of course usually refers to listed asset classes. But the reality is that quite a significant value creation in the future sits in alternatives, in private markets. And this is where fees need to come to terms with long-term sustainability, and they haven't adjusted to it. But I very much expect that they will, because at the end of the day, what we look for our clients, for asset owners, is value for money, which is the most important thing. And of course, if you do active, if you do all this analysis, if you work with private assets, you're expected to pay to be paid more than you get from the index, but you are not expected to get rich.
But I just want to stay with this for a minute, because you've also commented that many companies are choosing to stay private for longer rather than go public. So do you just have to sometimes swallow the fact that those managing in the private equity space do have a much higher fee schedule? And how do you balance that when you are looking at the alternatives?
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting stage in the market. Yes, more companies stay private for longer, but then at the same time, the recent performance has been so successful that there is just this supply and demand imbalance there. My explanation why alternative asset managers, well, it's hedge funds, they have adjusted their fee structures. It's mostly private markets and private equity in particular where we still see the imbalance. And I think it's just at the moment the pure supply demand, and at some point it will have to adjust. And there is also an element, I do expect a lot of evolution in private markets, because at the moment there is another constraint there, that illiquidity, not so many investors are not able to afford investing in private markets because of the regulatory constraints. If we think about defined contribution, either in the UK or in the US, there are very strong requirements there about liquidity. There are also strong demands, rightly so, about how much you are allowed to pay in fees. And as a result, it essentially blocks out these large investors who are growing from a very significant opportunity set. So what we need to do as an industry is actually work on how to make this part of the market, A, cheaper in terms of fees, better value for money, and B, more liquid.
Now, there are in the UK, ironically, a series of investment trusts where retail investors or high net worth individuals can access private assets through investment trusts. So what I think you're saying, because I would imagine the liquidity in those pools is insufficient for you to be able to allocate, is you've got at the very top level, you can allocate to those managers. And at the bottom level, ironically, you can, but it's the middle tranche for large mandates that are struggling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I want to move to something that I'm not sure I've ever understood. You've written about it, and I think you're quite keen on it. And that's this idea of smart beta. So I'd like you to explain what you mean by that and why it's figuring as a component in your investment decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that I'm proud of, that's one of the reasons I have worked in this company for 17 years, is because of the innovation. And smart beta was one of the earlier innovation in our investment practice. And the idea there is quite simple. So you have index, but as we discussed, index often is not perfect. But the very attractive characteristic of the index is that it is cheap. The cost is low. So the question is how you make it more attractive from an investment perspective while keeping it cheap. One way to do it is actually to change the rules of the index to reflect some of your beliefs or some of the changes in the market. So maybe just take two examples. The first one is beliefs. If you do believe in the fact that ESG matters and that some of the factors, environmental or social, are not properly reflected in the index and in the pricing, then you can introduce relatively simple rules in the index that can help you reflect your beliefs. Maybe underweight carbon-intensive businesses or underweight those businesses that have controversies related to social factors. So that's possible, and this actually allows you to keep the index cheap. Another way is just if you think about the development in the market, I was talking about the concentration of the traditional indices, that they have such exposure to technology segment and also such exposure to the largest six stocks in the market. You end up with like a quarter of your index in six stocks. So what you could do is actually limit the exposure and essentially calculate your index not by market capitalization, but by the number of stock, essentially allow every stock to have an equal weight and then distribute it in a way that it still remains diversified and your smallest stock don't take most of the index. So introducing these rules actually allows you to keep costs low, stay liquid, but then at the same time reflecting your investment beliefs, views in your portfolio.
So you've joined the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, which I believe has committed to a net zero target for all your global delegated assets. Tell me a little bit about, because you've been working on this for a while, this isn't new territory for you. Tell me a little bit about how your thinking has changed and what have become, you know, the priorities now as you look forward.
So our thinking had changed before we joined the initiative. So there had been a lot of thought invested into, do we actually make the public commitment and do we join the Net Zero Asset Manager Initiative? And also more recently, we essentially founded the Net Zero Investment Consultants Initiative. So we actually made the commitment to net zero by 2050, not only on our delegated assets, but also on our assets under advice. And the reason for that is our understanding and belief that societal expectations as to what needs to happen to limit the temperature rise and to mitigate the effects of climate change, they have shifted so dramatically that puts pressure on governments around the world, and governments around the world have started to act. So net zero by 2050 is the law here in the UK. In the US, we saw last year after Biden was elected as the president, the first thing he did is re-enter the Paris Agreement. China, the second largest economy in the world, also making the public commitment to become carbon neutral by 2060. What it means is that governments will act, and this action will lead to the complete restructuring of the economy. Every business is going to be affected, no matter which segment of the market or which geography they're in. And what it means for our clients from a financial perspective, you just cannot ignore this risk. Mm-hmm. And the best thing that you could do as an investor is actually understand this risk and try to stay strategically ahead of this restructuring happening in the economy. And making this public commitment essentially allows you to ensure that you have the understanding, the measurement of the overall transition. You also become part of the network of other investors, be it asset managers or asset owners or other consultants, where you work together on assessing these systemic risks and try to catalyze collective action. Because every individual investor, we could potentially decarbonize our portfolios very quickly, but it's not going to help us with long-term risk that if the temperature does go above 2 degrees, there will be capital impairment. So it is a massive financial risk, but it is systemic, so you cannot solve it. And hence our individual commitment, but then at the same time, joining and indeed encouraging the creation of collective initiatives and action.
So you've written in one of your reports, and I quote you, it's now becoming accepted that investors should not allow the use of external carbon offsets as a significant long-term strategy for decarbonization goals. Again, I'd like you just to expand on that, because this is a lot of this carbon credit business that has grown up and other variations are upon us. And I've seen and listened to managers who are weighing up how exactly they can move in the direction they want.
Well, this market is very important for our ability to manage the transition to a low carbon economy. But at the moment, it's very nascent, fragmented. What represents a carbon offset? The definition is not settled. And the reason for the current view of not using offsets for your transition plans and for offsetting your carbon exposure is essentially around incentives. Because at the moment, what needs to happen in the near term before 2030, businesses in our economy need to come up with transition plans, and they need to come up with transition plans that cost them less than their future earning power. And if in their planning around transitions, they start factoring in how they can use carbon offsets, the incentive to figure out this proposition where they can transition but remain profitable just decreases. Obviously, there will be segments where you cannot technologically transition without using offsets. But in the near term and in our portfolios, it's pretty clear that we shouldn't be using offsets and we should be encouraging better, more efficient and more innovative transition to the low carbon economy.
So let's take that and then talk about manager selection, because you are examining managers weekly with your team, daily, intensively. So high level question, first of all, if you are an asset manager, how do you get noticed by your firm?
Yeah, well, it's a very competitive market, isn't it? So I have more than 100 people doing manager research, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, dedicated teams in the market. But then the number of strategies that we have to research, I think it's 100,000 and counting. So there is no way that even with 100 people, you can do due diligence on all of them. We do use technology, so that helps. So collecting data from managers and then applying technology and machine learning techniques. So the initial screening is done by data collection and technological assessment. So we collect the data and then we apply algorithms to give us the initial view. And then after that, we very quickly narrow it down to the ideas where we feel that there is potential to fit into the portfolio. And it will be driven both from bottom up, where a view comes across as potentially attractive, but also from top down. If, for example, we are interested more in private markets or technologies that would support the transition to the low carbon economy. So we'll be looking for managers that specialize in these segments and we'll be giving them a bit more of a chance. And then after that, we do deep dives on those strategies that look interesting. And I'm sort of describing it a little bit like black and white, as if it is one-off process. Of course, we have been doing it for 30 years, so there is a massive institutional knowledge as well on different teams, different managers, and the industry is very fluid. People move around, and it's very important to have this institutional knowledge. And the way we do research and what I strongly encourage with my team is just think about it that off-the-shelf products, more often than not, they're driven by asset managers and their incentives and their interests, while our role in the value chain is actually close to asset owner. Our value proposition is better understanding the needs of asset owners. And as a result, we more often than not, instead of taking products off the shelf from the asset management industry, we would come to those managers whom we identify as having potential skill, capabilities, the right culture, the right thinking. And then we will work together with them to create products that would fit into our clients' interests and demands. And it's quite surprising, the whole gap between what asset owners need and what the asset management industry is able to offer. I have been the head of research for 8 years, and just during this period, we're counting more than 100 different structures and products that we created for our clients, partnering with the asset managers. And this is where you're able to do a much better and more sustainable proposition, where you think about, okay, so what is the risk that I'm happy to take? What is the duration of the product? How do I structure the fee so it's not only good value for money, but also alignment of interest is achieved there.
I guess that to help all of us think about manager selection, give me a sense of the typical timelines between your first meeting with a manager and then either investing in their established product or the tailored one that you've created.
The question that often comes in RFPs for us, so we calculated the number of hours that would normally go into due diligence. And it's around 200 hours for us from scratch to the final rating decision. The challenge is that it's not 200 hours that are happening within a month or two. There are occasional situations where, because it is urgent and because, for example, we know the team and they span out and they're raising a fund and they're in demand, so we can turn it around quickly. But the reality is that more often than not, these 200 hours will be spent over years and years as we get to know the team better, as we see how they do, as we do references on them. So it really depends on the strategy, on the situation. And in many instances, it's actually very, very long term. We get to know people and then it takes 4 or 5 years before the opportunity comes from top down for them. And then we come to them and we create something interesting together.
And are there some clear red lines when you've done your initial search? Are there some things that just simply you can't proceed? And if so, what are they?
Because you're essentially talking about 100,000 strategies and you need to select, so we probably have less than 1,000 highly rated products, preferred products that we use with our clients. So you, in this competitive market, you have the luxury to very quickly identify those firms where your red lines, you are nowhere near crossing them. But just thinking about what would be the red lines that we set there, there are some hygiene factors, right? So the process, the team, more recently, culture. It's not define it as a red line, but we started spending so much more time on culture. And it has become significant factor, and I can see a number of instances where we walked away from a firm that was very promising, but then we couldn't quite get comfortable with the culture, so it's becoming to a degree a red line. Another one, big themes for us in our due diligence are around sustainability, climate, and diversity of investment teams, where the industry is the state that is in a continuous evolution, and it's obviously not perfect because there is room for improvement for everyone. And what we are trying to do is engage with managers, set our expectations, agree with them that as true partners, they would be evolving in line with our expectations and our clients' expectations. But if this evolution doesn't happen with the pace that we expect, then that would be a red line for us as well.
So you look at all these components that make up the ultimate portfolios that you advise and manage on. Just looking ahead, next 10 years, what do you think will be the big changes in the investment landscape in terms of how the investment management industry evolves?
One big change that is already happening, and it's probably how you think about 10 years ahead, is you are picking up signals that are already out there and they're indicating that these initial signs are going to become big, is the whole movement from individual star investors towards teams. So it is already happening. People start appreciating the value of cognitive diversity in investment decision-making, the value of not being dependent on one single person in what is an institutional value proposition, institutional firm, but it's not happening quickly enough. So I very much can see how the asset management industry will move even further towards becoming a team sport rather than individual sport. So that's one big thing. Another one is, of course, everything related to a low carbon economy. We spoke about the upcoming restructuring. So it's thinking about the investment skill. In the past, it was very much driven by understanding the economy and finance. Now you have to understand a bit of climate science and how it translates into financial decisions. So investment professionals of the future will have to upgrade their knowledge of climate science. And then the third big topic that I see is actually related to why our industry exists and the purpose of it. So there is a clear shift just in 25 years that I have been doing it. When I started it, it was all about making money. At the moment, if we go to do due diligence on the manager and ask them about their purpose, and if the only answer that they give us is to make money for themselves, we'll probably very quickly get out of the door.
Well, but you could admire them for their honesty.
Exactly. It was an acceptable answer a decade ago. So having a purpose that goes beyond an individual and indeed beyond a firm, actually, it's a model for success in the future. It's a model to be sustainable for our industry, but also for individual players in the industry.
But I just want to challenge you a bit on that, because something is sort of, there's an alarm bell ringing in my head, okay, which is that there are a few really great managers who have emerged over the decades, and we can bring some of them to mind. And they were unusual creatures. Not that they always performed, because as we know from Buffett and others, you go through periods of underperformance. But the more people you put around the table, the more potential you have to dilute one of the powerful thinkers. So aren't you really saying that you will sacrifice some of the great performers because they don't fit the bill of that truly diversified investment team?
I think what I'm saying is that it was possible in the past, as one person, one talented maverick, to have a sustainable investment proposition, to sit in the room with a Bloomberg screen doing lots of analysis and coming up with insight. The market, society, economy have changed to such a degree that just having one person's perspective is no longer enough. So to be able to be successful, you need to create a structure in which you can harness different perspectives, different backgrounds, different demographic diversity, different cultural experiences. And if you're not able to do that, then you are very likely to miss the trick. And you referred to the past, Simon, that the successful organizations of the past, yes, indeed. But the challenge of our jobs is that we are not assessing the past, right? Actually, we are trying to distance ourselves from the past as much as possible, because the fact that they were successful in the past doesn't really guarantee that they will be successful in the future. And what I'm saying is that the attributes and the factors of how to be successful in the future have changed dramatically.
I hear that, although that would presuppose that there isn't going to be extraordinary investment talent that rises above the pack, and a lot of those individuals will want to be associated with their own vehicles. And so I just wonder, and maybe we're just going to agree to disagree here, that there is going to always be that star component, and often that is associated with a desire not to work in a large institution. So you get the splintering, and I know you as an organization actually back some of those organizations where people leave. So when you go and back some of those, again, just tell me how you weigh up that tension.
Well, maybe it's just the way we interpret the star, definition of the star. I definitely think there are advantages and disadvantages related to big organizations versus small organizations. And with small organizations, it's so much easier to create alignment. And you are right that often there will be one founder or two. What I am saying is that what is going to set those firms to be successful in the future is that if they're able to bring talent in that and create the environment for this talent that allows to harness the difference of perspectives, they can still be very small, and that would allow them to align better, to own their future. I very much like this model in the alternative space in particular. So as I said, I started my career in private equity. I really like small private equity niche players rather than big houses. So there is definitely a model for smaller firms, but I don't think what I usually associate with the star managers is just this confidence in your own perspective and inability to open up and synthesize others' views. And that's not going to work in the future. You have to be continuously open and challenging yourself. And the only way to do it, if you have credible sparring partners.
Right. Well, I hear you, and you
honestly, yes.
Well, I don't actually know whether we do agree, because I think you can, because I do think that you can receive all sorts of inputs as a strongly opinionated manager, but have that growth mindset, have that ability to contest, challenge, listen. And I mean, the great investors will take the calls from, and then they synthesize this still. But we're going to leave that, because I'd like to talk about NEDs, non-executive directors. We haven't done that on the show, and a lot of our listeners will at some point in time. Some are, some will be thinking about. You have become, I think, via new role, a non-executive director for the Investor Forum. And I think it'd be great for you just to tell us why you did that, but also the process of being and becoming an NED.
Absolutely. So I think the way I was thinking about this step, I spoke at the start of our conversation about change. And if I think about my career journey, I was always looking for change. It's just really like this fact when you bring something new, a different perspective into what you do. And I have been with my firm for 17 years and have done so many things here. And a few years ago, I was thinking, well, it would be really good to get an external perspective into my day job. But I really, I love the work that I do. I absolutely don't want to leave. So is there a way to do both? And non-executive directorship is such a perfect way to achieve this. Actually do something different and allow yourself this fresh ideas, exposure to something that is not your day-to-day routine, but then at the same time continue with career journey. The way I got into it, I, as always, thought that firstly I need to train myself. So there is a very good course run by the Financial Times that gives the technical training, but also more importantly, they do the coaching how to be a non-executive director, because it's a very different role, especially when you are executive and manage a pretty large team of people. It's not an easy transition to just become a non-executive, be a voice around the table. So the training was excellent. And then I was looking for an opportunity and finding something that is also aligned with what I really believe was very lucky. It was not easy. But I did find the opportunity with the Investor Forum, and this is a not-profit organization, and what they focus on is collective engagement with listed companies here in the UK. And it's very much in line with what we try to advocate with our clients. But then at the same time, it's a small business, it's a non-profit, but you are non-executive at the table and you think how to make it better, how to help them improve, how they can do a better job. And I think that it really has made me much better as an executive in my day-to-day job. But then at the same time, being an executive, I'm also able to bring more insights when I am at this board table as a non-executive. So I would strongly recommend. I know that at the moment, many people think about semi-retiring into the non-executive portfolio type of career. That's a sensible move. But I do think that in order to be able to do it successfully, it's probably best to start with picking up one or two non-executive roles while still being in the executive position.
That's an interesting perspective. Well, so let's move to some general questions. If you could just meet with one investor from around the world, who would it be?
I think I'm in such a privileged job, Simon, that it's almost an impossible question to me. What I love about my job is that I actually can meet some of the best talent in our industry. So I don't know if
you met them all. I mean, clearly, you just need to pick up the phone. Well, that's a great position to be in. I'd like to ask you a geopolitical question. The Russian tensions involving Lithuania are growing. Those of us who are students of history feel there may be an echo with the past. How do you, as somebody who understands more about that region, process what's going on?
At the moment, it's very sad for me. Having lived in Russia, UK, US, having been exposed to how facts are presented, I just understand that it's really difficult. You never know where the actual truth is. But the problem is that I built my life on the principle that the world is becoming more united, that national borders matter less. And then in the last few years, unfortunately, we are seeing a reversal, and it only makes me sad.
What's your most important daily habit?
I think exercising is incredibly important, and it only came to me with age, but now if I don't take time to exercise during the day, then it's very likely that I don't think as clearly the next day. So going for a run or taking a yoga class is a very important daily habit for me. And I'm so glad that I have managed to make it daily.
You talked about some of the things that you would like to see change in the investment industry, but is there one particular pet beef, something that really annoys you about the industry that if you could change it quickly, you would author that change?
I do think that that would be around the purpose. We did talk about that, but I do want our industry to be less obsessed about margins, about costs. Of course, the sustainability of businesses is important, but the reality is if we compare our industry with the rest of the society, we are all very well off. And just thinking more about what value do we bring to this society, I think is what I would like to see more of.
And what advice would you give to a 20-year-old Luba?
I would probably ask myself to be a bit more flexible. I just was a bit too black and white. One explanation is where I grew up and how I saw it changing. But yeah, my advice to my 20-year-old self would be just to be a little bit flexible about decisions, that it's nothing is black and white, nothing is right and wrong, that the truth is often in the middle. And this wisdom has only been built up over time. And when I think about some of my earlier decisions, I would have probably made some better decisions if I had known that earlier on. But well, look, it's just, unfortunately, it only comes with making those mistakes that you acquire wisdom.
Yes, well, I think it should be that way, actually. And my final question is, students, the young people listening to this show who are thinking about finance, some advice that you would offer them?
Oh, it's a wonderful career. I just so much have enjoyed. Literally, I stumbled into finance, but that's an opportunity to help our society, our economy, to create value, to allocate capital to those ideas, those assets that can help us, the human race, the society, to continue improving, evolving, tackling climate change. There is a massive sense of purpose when you do it right. So I would encourage the younger people who are considering their career to seriously think about finance.
And younger women as well? Do you think enough is being done to really welcome them into the financial workplace?
Not enough, unfortunately. We should all be doing more, but there has been a very marked change. I am no longer the only woman in the room, actually most of the time, just thinking about my firm or asset managers that we work with. It's just a really much more comfortable place for women, and we will continue doing our best to make it even more comfortable.
Well, I think the military's loss was perhaps finance's gain in your choice of career.
Indeed.
So, Luba, I think that's it. You know, we've had a terrific conversation. I'm going to take away a number of things. One in particular, since we hadn't talked about the non-executive directors, is that rather than people thinking about it as something they do when they have left an organization, to think about it whilst it's there because of the additional perspectives that it brings. So, Luba, it's been terrific having this conversation with you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Simon. I was talking about going for a run, and I must say that many of my runs are accompanied with your show. So it's such a privilege to actually now be one of the guests. So thank you for having me.
Oh, my. Thank you very much indeed. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.